The Murthy law firm has been clarifying US immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. Teleconferences and podcasts were added to the resources available online in 2012. We are happy to offer this free service. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us for today's discussion on the other non-immigrant options that are available to those who have not been selected in the H-1B lottery. As all of you can imagine, this is of grave concern to employers, to individuals, to their families on, oh my God, I did not get selected in the lottery, and this is either my 1 year of the 1 year F-1 OPT or I get, or the 3rd year of my STEM OPT. I've tried each year and I still haven't been selected. Now what happens to me? What are my options? Where do I go from here? How do I protect myself? Joining me for today's discussion are two of my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, people I'm proud to call not just brilliant, smart lawyers, but friends too, because they truly care about making a difference in the lives of our clients and their families. We have Kanya Sanders, who has, I think, over 25 years of immigration law experience. I'm getting close to 40, so I guess I'm showing my age, but also our wisdom and our brilliance, if I can say so. And Maggie Wagner, who may fool you with her youth, but not her brilliance. We have a great team here to discuss these issues with you. As we often say, the three most common statuses that people try to work in the U.S. in the employment-based arena for most tech companies and educated people tends to be H-1B status, the L-1A, L-1B, or the F-1 OPT for the 1 year or the 2 extra years for STEM OPT grads, right? So now today we're going to talk about all of the other options that you have. So first we start with the H-1B cap exempt employment. So if you didn't get selected in the lottery with your regular cap subject employer, try to find a job with a cap exempt employer. What does that mean? It's usually an institution of higher education. It's a nonprofit entity which is related to or affiliated with an institution of higher education. It's a nonprofit research organization or a government research organization. And as we've said in other cases, it's a really clever distinction. It is not necessary for the H-1 employee to actually work for that entity, but only requires work at the institution of higher education or one of these institutions that I described to be considered CAP exempt. And in order to explain this in greater detail and what that means, I'm going to invite Kanya to talk and explain how this process works. Kanya.
Thank you, Sheila. Right. So first of all, I just want to explain what an institution of higher education that qualifies for the CAP to be a CAP exempt H-1B employer. First of all, they have to be a public or nonprofit university or institution of higher education. They have to provide admission to students who have earned a secondary education. They have to be licensed by the proper institution to provide education beyond the secondary school and offer educational programs which award a bachelor's degree or at the minimum a 2-year associate's degree. Now to define what it means when you say that they don't have to be directly employed by the CAP exempt institution, but they can even be employed by a CAP subject company, but placed at or working for an institution of higher education or a CAP exempt institution. So under the new rule that went into effect this January, a CAP exempt petition can be filed by a company that does not qualify as a CAP exempt organization, which most companies are, as long as the employee will spend at least half of their time providing essential work that supports or advances a fundamental purpose, mission, objective, or function of a qualifying CAP-exempt organization. Now, the rule also makes it clear that employee doesn't even have to be working at the location of the CAP-exempt organization. They can even work remotely from home as long as at least 50% of their time is working for the qualifying CAP-exempt organization, as we, as I previously said, providing essential work that supports or advances a fundamental purpose, mission, objective, or function of that qualifying organization.
Great. Thank you, Kanya. So there's also been a change under the new rules that became effective from January 17th of 2025 on what the definition is of a nonprofit research organization and a government research organization. So, you know, Maggie, let me have you invite you to speak a little bit on that, because it might be relevant and very helpful for those who probably could take advantage of this exception.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So I'll start out by saying this is meant to be a less restrictive definition of a nonprofit and research organization or government research organization. It's supposed to be less restrictive and, you know, allow more employees to kind of take advantage of this. And what they did was for a nonprofit research organization or a government research organization, they replaced the terms primarily engaged and primary mission with fundamental activity. So what that means is, you know, under the previous rule, nonprofit entities and government research organizations had to have research as their primary mission and had to be primarily engaged in research. And now, under the new rule, nonprofit entities and government research organizations only need research to be a, quote, fundamental activity. And, you know, they, so as long as research is a fundamental activity of that nonprofit research organization or government research organization, they should be able to establish exemption from the annual statutory limit on H-1B visas. So, again, it's meant to be a less restrictive definition and allow more people to be able to take advantage of CAP-exempt petitions.
Wonderful. Thank you for that clarification, because I think it was easy to get confused between what's primary, what's this, and by you saying it's meant to be less restrictive, I think is a good, important tip for employers to want to consider. So, of course, there are certain specific categories for citizens of certain countries that are eligible for their own unique kind of exceptions. For example, we often use Canada and Mexico, because it used to be called NAFTA, now it's called the USMCA, the US-Mexico-Canada Agreement. You have Australia, and you have a few other countries, right? And we'll discuss those in greater detail. Again, remember, this is not restricted to the person's country of birth, like we do with the priority date count most times, but it is the country of citizenship. So, for example, if a person born in India later obtains citizenship, let's say in Canada or Australia, which is fairly common, they could actually be eligible to take advantage of either the TN classification as Canadian or the E3 as an Australian citizen. But remember, this is limited to citizens only and not permanent residents of those countries that enjoy these specific provisions under the law for these special categories. So as we will discuss, they are still required to meet certain other criteria qualifications to be eligible. And why don't we get started with the most common status, which is used routinely by our clients to become Canadian citizens, namely the TN visa. So Kanya, why don't you, let's get started with the discussion.
Thank you, Sheila. So, right, so the TN visa category, as you mentioned, it's, you know, it's available to our neighbors to the north and south, you know, namely Canada and Mexico. And this category, as you mentioned, is based on the, you know, the US-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or the USMCA Treaty, as it's called. One of the, of course, the fundamental requirements to qualify for TN is that the person must be a citizen of Canada or Mexico. Okay. The other important fact to remember for TN is that not all positions qualify for TN. The occupations that qualify for TN are listed in the USMCA agreement. Also, something interesting to keep in mind is that all the positions in the list are not necessarily professional. So, you know, there are professional as well as non-professional positions that would qualify for the TN. You know, there are kind of like truck drivers, you know, because they are also because of the trade and commerce between US and Canada. The list of qualifying professions is pretty long, but some of the notable ones include accountants, doctors, registered nurses, pharmacists, all manner of scientists, university professors, hotel managers, computer systems analysts, lawyers, even we can get TN, and engineers, including, you know, software engineers. Now, for the majority of the professional positions, the applicant must have obtained a college degree in a related field. Experience alone or even a combination of education and experience generally will not be sufficient. So these are kind of like the fundamental requirements, you know, for the TN.
So the next thing that we often talk about, I know people always say, well, you know, I'd like to be this position of a management consultant, and we keep talking about that being a much higher standard. So I think it might help to delve into it a little bit deeper, because that is the one exception for Canadians and Mexicans technically, but Canadians are the ones who tend to come into the U.S. as management consultants. So Maggie, if I could have you explain that a little bit more.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so like Tanya was saying, you know, experience alone generally isn't going to suffice. But, you know, one notable exception to this is the position of a management consultant. And that person, if somebody is applying to be a management consultant, that person can qualify based on either a degree or at least 5 years of relevant experience. So that's one case where, you know, 5 years of relevant experience will suffice. But something to keep in mind with this management consultant position is that, unfortunately, immigration officials do tend to scrutinize it a little bit more closely than other TN applications. And it's important to keep in mind that, you know, one, the position has to be temporary. And two, you know, someone coming to be a management consultant can't be coming to fill an existing opening, replacing someone in an existing position, or filling a newly created permanent position. And although a petition can be filed with USCIS for a TN position, it's important to remember that Canadians can actually apply directly at the port of entry since they're visa exempt. So, you know, Canadians can apply directly at the port of entry, but unfortunately Mexicans, however, have to apply for a visa at the U.S. embassy or consulate because they are not visa exempt. So there's no requirement that a petition has to be approved ahead of time if you are going to use the consular option for either Canadians or Mexicans. And so that can help with a timeline situation. You can get it a little bit more quickly because you don't have to file with USCIS, get an approval, and then go to the consulate. You can just apply directly at the consulate.
Great. So I know there was a little bit of discussion about self-employment. And it sounds a little bit like the new regulations that we have on self-employment for H-1B petitions, right?
Right.
Where, you know, the interesting thing is for Canadians, there was always this exemption for self-employment, right?
Right. Yeah. So unfortunately, self-employment is not permitted, but a person can be sponsored by a Canadian company to perform work for a U.S. company. So in that situation, the sponsored worker can be an owner of the Canadian company.
Sounds a lot like the self-sponsorship. I can be the full owner of the Canadian company, which is sponsoring and working with the U.S. company. So it's sounding hell of a lot like the H-1B new regulations, which allow self-sponsorship, which I know is the regulation under the Biden administration, but I think we're seeing some potential pushback in RFPs and questions now under the current administration in the last few weeks that we just started seeing at the Moosey Law Firm.
Right.
So how long is the TN granted for and dependents?
It's typically granted for 3-year increments. It can be extended indefinitely so long as the person actually continues to otherwise qualify for the TN. And TN dependents can be admitted in TD status, but unfortunately they don't have work authorization.
Great. Thank you, Maggie. So as you can see, besides the, if you didn't get selected in the CAP and you're not eligible for the L1 or the F1 OPT, you now have either one of these sort of options through the Canadian, like the TN or the Mexican, or like we first talked about the CAP exempt employment, then the TN. And next we're going to jump to what's called the treaty traders and treaty investors, which are the E1 and E2 categories, right? And these are available to foreign nationals with where the United States has a bilateral treaty of friendship, trade, and commerce with that country. So the E1 and E2 treaty traders, treaty investors, they can come to the U.S., but they need to either carry on substantial international trade that is considered to be mainly between the U.S. and that treaty country, or they can come in to develop and direct the operations of a U.S. company. Now, the E2 treaty investors require, the category requires the individual or the entity, the company, to have made a substantial investment in the U.S. enterprise. A lot of people use the E1 and E2 to work in a supervisory, executive, or essential skills types of positions for a qualifying employer. Now, if the person obtains citizenship of a third country, let's say a person who's not eligible because there's no bilateral treaty of friendship and commerce between the U.S. and that country, becomes a citizen of a third country through investment, then to be considered a citizen of that country for the purposes of E1 and E2, the person must be domiciled in that treaty country for a continuous period of not less than 3 years at any point before actually applying for the E1 or E2 visas. So you actually have to live there for a continuous period of 3 years to qualify for the E1, E2 treaty trader or treaty investor category. So these classifications actually work quite well for large established companies, but we have also seen that they can be utilized by entrepreneurs who are looking to build their own startup companies in the U.S. Now, E2 and E1, E1 and E2 are not available, obviously, for all foreign nationals because that's specific. There has to be that specific treaty between that country and the U.S., as I just explained a few minutes ago. So only people who are citizens of a country that has that signed qualifying treaty can apply. Now, the list of countries is actually very long, and it ranges from countries like Japan to Australia, most of the European Union, and to some less obvious countries, believe it or not, such as Iran and Pakistan and even Taiwan. Most of these countries have treaties that cover both the E1 and the E2 categories because their citizens get the same, U.S. citizens get similar rights in that country. But some may only be eligible for either the E1 or the E2. Many are eligible for both, but so you really have to look at that particular treaty to understand what's involved. So a lot of countries don't, Kanya, maybe we need to have you discuss more details about, you know, why are some countries either left out and what are their options and, you know, et cetera.
Right. Thank you, Sheila. So unfortunately, at this time, some of the largest countries in the world do not have an E1 and E2 treaty, you know, with the U.S., notably India and mainland China. So it is nationals of these countries who then, you know, try to get citizenship in a third country that you were explaining before by investment and then, you know, apply as a citizen of that country. You know, and then as you said, you know, U.S. brought in that, you know, domicile rule that you have to be domiciled for 3 years. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit of the E1 category for treaty traders. So to qualify for the E1 treaty trader, the company abroad or the individual who is a trader must engage in what they call substantial trade between the treaty country and the United States. Now, although the regulations themselves hasn't defined what substantial means, the Department of State has provided some guidelines in the Foreign Affairs Manual. Now, according to the Foreign Affairs Manual, the investment, what substantial means, it must be an amount of trade sufficient to ensure a continuous flow of international trade between the U.S. and the treaty country. It cannot be based on a single transaction. There should be a continuous flow of trade. And three, volume of exchange is the primary focus, but monetary value is also important. So cases that involve more numerous transactions of larger value have a better chance of approval. Now, and also the other point to keep in mind is more than half of the total amount of international trade conducted by the business must be between the U.S. and the treaty country. Now, the person applying for the E1 can either be coming to carry on the substantial trade between the U.S. and the treaty country, or the person can be coming as a key employee of the company, such as an executive or a supervisor or an employee with essential skills.
Great. Thank you, Kanya. Before we jump to Maggie to talk a little bit about E2 treaty, you know, the treaty investor, treaty trader and treaty investor category that we talked about. Okay, so thank you so much for that discussion, Kanya. Let's jump to E3 because I see we're running short on time, which is primarily for citizens of Australia. So why don't I have you, Maggie, discuss briefly what it entails, because a lot of Australian citizens use this because it's very similar to the H1B category.
Yeah, sure. So E3 visas are available for citizens of Australia, like you said. They're coming to the U.S. to perform services in a specialty occupation. So kind of similar to the H-1B, but it's an occupation that requires theoretical and practical application of a specialized knowledge and attainment of a bachelor's degree in a specific specialty or higher for entry into the occupation. So again, pretty much the same as an H-1B classification. And the E3 visa is, you know, nearly identical to the process of H-1B employment as well, including the requirement of completing a labor condition application, so an LCA, what a lot of people call it, with the Department of Labor. However, if the person is outside of the U.S., they're not required to file an I-129 with USCIS. They're just required to do the labor condition application and have that certified by the Department of Labor. And then the beneficiary can apply directly at the U.S. consulate and enter on the E3 visa. So, and if the applicant does not have the equivalent of a bachelor's degree, they can combine education and experience to, you know, form the equivalent of a bachelor's degree, much like the H-1B again. And there's only 10,500 visas that are set aside for this category each fiscal year, but this number has never been used up. So E3 is always a good option to keep in mind. And dependent spouses are granted E3S status, and dependent children are granted E3D status. And dependent spouses in the E3S status are authorized to work incident to status. And these petitions are approved generally for 2 years at a time, and they can be renewed indefinitely. It seems like a good option for people to keep in mind.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Maggie. So let's try to kind of move things along because I see we are kind of running short on time here. I'll just talk briefly about O-1 visas. Maybe then Kanya can talk briefly in a minute or two about J-1s. And finally, we'll have Maggie, you talk about religious workers, and then we'll just wrap it up. So the O-1 is very similar to the extraordinary abilities for people who have reached the top of their field in science, education, business, or athletics. you need a written advisory opinion or what's called a consultation, but it can be waived in certain situations. And it may be based either on one single offer of employment or multiple offers of employment, right? And usually they can be valid for a maximum of 3 years with extensions in 1 year increments for basically unlimited duration, because these are people that we consider to be truly extraordinary achievement. Lex, let's jump for a minute to the J-1 exchange category, Kanya.
Yes, so the J-1 exchange category is something that is administered by the Department of State. And, you know, it is based on an, you know, what they call an exchange work and study based exchange visitor program. You know, there are like several categories that qualify for the J-1, like professor, researcher, scholar, short-term scholar, student, camp counselor, au pair, summer work, travel, intern, trainee, specialist, physician. So there's several categories, and each one has its own requirements, and some are subject to a two-year foreign residency requirement, some are not. So that is, you know, another option to consider.
Excellent summary, Kanya. I'm like trying to wrap up what we had planned to discuss for 5 or 10 minutes in less than a minute or two. Fantastic. Okay, the last option that we are going to discuss today is the religious worker or R category. So if you could just give a quick overview, Maggie.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the religious worker visa or the R visa is for individuals who are coming to the U.S. to work temporarily as either, you know, a minister or in a religious vocation or occupation. And so there's three different ways that, you know, you can qualify for an R visa. You can be a minister or either, you know, a minister employed in a religious vocation or a religious occupation. And the main thing to keep in mind is that you can't just come on an R visa and work in an administrative position, you know, just kind of doing filings for the religious organization or things like that. You actually have to be, you know, performing, you know, religious work in a religious vocation.
Excellent. Thank you so much for, again, wrapping up what we had planned to discuss at great length in less than a minute or two. So as you can see from this wonderful interactive discussion between Kanya Sanders, Maggie Wagner, and myself, you know, there's a lot of options for you to consider, whether you're an employer, whether you're an employee. And again, we've just gone through what we think are some of the major options for you to consider. Hopefully you've been selected in the lottery. Hopefully you're ready to get cracking with your first H-1B job. But if not, don't lose faith. Don't lose hope. You have the wonderful, fantastic, brilliant, knowledgeable attorneys and legal team at the Murthy Law Firm able to guide you and to discuss your options if, God forbid, you are not selected in the lottery. So on behalf of myself, Sheila Murthy, on behalf of Kanya Sanders, Maggie Wagner, and the entire Murthy Law Firm team, we thank you so much for joining us for today's discussion. We look forward to helping you, your company, your family, and your business. Please feel free to refer not just your own business and your family, but also your friends and colleagues to the world's most preeminent U.S. immigration law firm. We hope you're enjoying this spring, and happy spring and summer. Have a great rest of your day. Bye-bye.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Murthy Law Firm. Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.